In 1516, Venetian authorities confined Jews to an island called Ghetto Nuovo, establishing a pattern of segregation that would echo across centuries. 500 years later, this concept remains both controversial and essential for understanding racial inequality in America. Mitchell Dunier's exploration of the ghetto traces its evolution from medieval Europe through Nazi Germany to American cities, challenging us to reconsider what we think we know about segregated spaces. The book has garnered praise from figures ranging from Ta-Nehisi Coates to sociologist William Julius Wilson, who called it a landmark contribution to our understanding of inequality. Its examination of how controlled spaces can simultaneously oppress and nurture community has made it required reading in urban studies programs nationwide. Through the stories of brilliant scholars who studied these spaces firsthand, many of whom faced exclusion from the very academic institutions analyzing their communities, we discover how the ghetto concept illuminates America's unresolved struggle with race and power. The term ghetto originated in Venice in 1516 when Jewish refugees fleeing war settled throughout the city, alarming many Venetians who prided themselves on having a most Catholic city. The Senate passed legislation requiring all Jews to live on an island in Cana Regio, already known as Ghetto Nuovo, New Ghetto, for its previous association with a copper foundry. Gates were erected with Christian guards who opened them at sunrise and closed them at sunset, with limited exceptions for doctors and merchants. Though Jews initially resisted moving there, the ghetto represented a compromise that legitimized their presence while controlling it. The Jews' right to stay in Venice remained tenuous, based on renewable 5-year charters for money lending. Despite these restrictions, the ghetto created a completely Jewish space with internal autonomy, allowing for a certain flourishing within the larger Christian city. Within a short time, ghetto came to define enclosed Jewish residential areas across Italy. The Roman ghetto, established in 1555 by Pope Paul IV's bull Cum Nimis Absurdum, forced Jews who had lived freely in Rome for generations into a small strip of land along the Tiber prone to flooding. The papal decree aimed officially to pressure Jews into conversion, but it primarily created a mechanism separating us from them. Despite physical separation, daily contact between Jews and Christians continued. When gates were open, Christians could enter the ghetto while Jews could leave to work outside. Culturally, Jews never stopped being Romans. They spoke Italian, albeit a Judeo-Romanesco variant, and remained knowledgeable about Italian culture. The ghetto presented a paradox. While creating disadvantages, it also allowed Jewish institutional life to continue and sometimes flourish. Napoleon was the first to attempt demolishing Italy's ghettos. In 1797, his troops tore down the gates of Ancona's ghetto and posted declarations renaming ghetto streets as Via della Libertà. Most Western European ghettos fell slowly but steadily. Rome's was among the slowest to disappear, as the papacy resisted Jewish integration. Only on September 20, 1870, when Italian troops entered Rome to complete Italy's unification, was the ghetto finally abolished and its residents granted full equality. By the early 20th century, ghetto acquired a new meaning. High-density neighborhoods inhabited voluntarily by Jews in cities like Warsaw, Prague, and New York's Lower East Side. Though not legally mandated, these ghettos still isolated residents from wider society. When Hitler rose to power in 1933, he cynically justified his anti-Jewish policies by claiming he was merely reviving church practices. The Catholic Church considered the Jews pestilent for 1,500 years, put them in ghettos. I am moving back toward the time in which a 1,500-year-long tradition was implemented. The Nazi ghetto represented unprecedented segregation. Unlike historical ghettos allowing daytime movement, Nazi ghettos trapped inhabitants day and night behind barbed wire. Those attempting escape were shot.
The Nazis turned these spaces into spectacles, with soldiers bringing coaches of visitors through as though it were a zoo, often striking inhabitants with whips and staging degrading scenes. Unlike religious justification for earlier ghettos, Nazi segregation was purely racial. When Hitler likened his plans to Catholic tradition, he deliberately misrepresented history. Even Nazi intellectuals acknowledged the medieval ghetto was, in essence, a voluntary community with business contacts between Jews and non-Jews. The Nazi ghetto demanded total segregation with any possibility of contact. Unlike historical ghettos where conversion offered escape, Nazi ghettos offered no way out. Ironically, when ghetto entered widespread use to describe black neighborhoods in the 1940s, it was the Nazi ghetto, not the 16th century version, that provided the reference point. For many black Americans after World War II, the Nazi ghetto became a powerful metaphor for their own experience, despite profound differences between Nazi Warsaw and places like Harlem or Chicago's South Side.
In October 1944, when Virginia Dobbins bought a house in a white Chicago neighborhood, neighbors destroyed the plumbing and torched the property while police refused protection. This incident exemplified the violence facing blacks who attempted to move beyond Chicago's overcrowded black areas. Horace Caton was no ordinary graduate student addressing the AME church gathering about this violence. Grandson of the first black U.S. Senator Hiram Revels, raised in Seattle where his parents published a newspaper, Caton had experienced remarkable highs and lows, from living with a servant in a white suburb to jail time for violating segregation laws. Beyond the bombings and police inaction, Caton exposed the sophisticated legal device of race-restrictive covenants that effectively sealed hundreds of thousands of blacks into tiny sections of Chicago's South Side. Unlike the Nazis' visible barbed wire, these private agreements among white property owners stipulated that properties couldn't be occupied, leased, or sold to blacks. Though appearing grassroots, these covenants were actually enforced by powerful national organizations like the National Association of Real Estate Boards. Housing patterns for blacks varied significantly across America. While Chicago had 86% of blacks living in majority black neighborhoods and New York had 70% in Harlem, Philadelphia showed only 55% segregation and Boston just 37%. Despite these variations, a demographic study concluded that a high degree of residential segregation typified every city with a sizable Negro population. 10 blocks from where Caton condemned racial covenants stood the University of Chicago, whose renowned sociology department was led by Robert E. Park. After working as a newspaper reporter, earning a doctorate in Heidelberg, and serving as Booker T. Washington's assistant at Tuskegee, Park developed an approach that sent students into Chicago's ethnic neighborhoods for firsthand observation. His students produced classic works like The Gold Coast and the Slum and The Taxi Dance Hall. As an undergraduate at the University of Washington, Caton aspired to study under Park. When they first met in 1930, Park dismissively claimed that Negroes didn't have any history. Incensed, Caton retorted, "Everything has a history, even the chair I am sitting in," and walked out. Despite this confrontation, Caton eventually applied to Chicago's doctoral program and was warmly welcomed by Park, beginning a lifelong friendship. Under Warner's guidance, Caton directed a massive Works Project Administration study that began as research on juvenile delinquency but expanded to examine the entire social structure of Chicago's black community. Leading a team of 150 to 200 interviewers, supervised by 20 graduate students, they operated from a church basement on the South Side. The researchers, primarily local residents studying their own communities, conducted nearly 10,000 interviews while documenting both lower-class life in public spaces and upper-class activities at fraternity and sorority dances. Lewis Wirth, Caton's other mentor and an early protege of Park, wrote his influential dissertation, The Ghetto, in 1928. Wirth argued that while ghettos were instruments of control and isolation, they also offered toleration and refuge for minorities.
He appreciated the religious and cultural vigor of Jewish ghettos, noting how they fostered ideals, aspirations, and passions alongside strong family life and achievements in commerce, literature, music, and philosophy. Yet Wirth remained deeply ambivalent, fearing ghettos aroused the worst passions of non-Jewish demagogues and hindered assimilation. Caton discovered the University of Chicago was actively supporting restrictive housing covenants that enclosed Chicago's Black Belt, contributing to the very conditions his research documented. The university financially backed the Woodlawn Property Owners Association, which boasted of completely excluding blacks from the university district. Association President T.L. Lusk declared, "We must refuse to sell to colored people, regardless of whether covenants are valid or invalid," suggesting they would make life unbearable for any who moved in. Whatever validity there might have been to the idea that Jewish ghettos and other ethnic neighborhoods in Chicago developed through natural economic and social forces, itself highly contested, Chicago's black communities were demonstrably not natural formations. When Wirth and Park first developed their theories about natural areas, the black ghetto barely existed. Black neighborhoods were historically less overwhelmingly black and were typically confined through intimidation and violence. Restrictive covenants that eventually created the ghetto only appeared in Chicago in 1927-28, when Wirth's book was likely already in press. During the Civil Rights era, the black ghetto gained greater prominence in social science, with Kenneth Clark emerging as a crucial figure. After restrictive covenants ended, attention had shifted away from the ghetto, but returned in the 1960s as the urban North became the next crucial civil rights battleground. Born to Jamaican parents in Panama, Clark moved to Harlem at age 5 and later attended Howard University, where scholars like E. Franklin Frazier and Alain Locke inspired his pursuit of racial justice through systematic study. As senior editor of the school newspaper in 1934, Clark wrote an editorial condemning segregation in Capitol restaurants that launched his civil rights career decades before the 1960s movement. When Clark and fellow Howard students picketed the Capitol, they were arrested but unexpectedly released by a sympathetic Irish police captain who declared they should be praised, not arrested. Their protest made the front page of the Washington Post, but Howard's president, fearing the loss of congressional funding, wanted Clark denied his diploma. Political scientist Ralph Bunche, a young faculty star who would later win the Nobel Peace Prize, threatened to resign if any students were expelled, beginning a lifelong friendship between Bunche and Clark. Though Myrtle initially found Clark's papers sloppy, Clark's persistence and Otto Kleinberg's intervention secured him a staff position on Myrtle's research team. Working with Kleinberg, Clark contributed research on race and intelligence that helped discredit theories supporting Southern racial caste systems, demonstrating there were no innate intellectual differences between blacks and whites. At City College, Clark taught future intellectual luminaries like Irving Kristol, Daniel Bell, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and Nathan Glazer, while continuing his research on prejudice in young children. His studies showing black children preferring white dolls became crucial evidence in Brown v. Board of Education, with the Supreme Court citing both his work and Myrtle's An American Dilemma. As a lifelong New Yorker, Clark recognized early that Northern black urban problems differed fundamentally from Southern civil rights issues. Housing segregation, slumlords, and police abuse couldn't be solved by desegregating lunch counters. Growing impatient with Northside's limited impact, Clark established Harlem Youth Opportunities Unlimited, HARU, in 1961 to secure federal funding for community improvement through action research. Before leaving HARU due to power struggles with Congressman Adam Clayton Cowell Jr., Clark directed a massive research project published as Youth in the Ghetto, which described Harlem as a powerless colony controlled by outside forces. This analysis, comparing ghetto residents to colonized peoples, would later influence the Black Power movement, despite Clark's personal opposition to black separatism. Despite Clark's prominence and Columbia University's location near his work at City College, there's no evidence Columbia ever seriously considered hiring this distinguished alumnus, whose research focused on their shared community. Instead, in 1964, Columbia hired Herbert Gans, a refugee from Nazi Germany who had studied under one of Park's protégés. The civil rights era brought profound changes to how scholars understood the ghetto. While Drake and Caton had viewed the ghetto primarily as a residential space where people suffered from external labor market discrimination, post-1965 Watts riots analysis transformed this understanding. Harvard economist John F. Keynes' groundbreaking 1964 paper first identified the spatial mismatch between where jobs were located and where poor people lived. 15 years of post-war suburban expansion had dramatically shifted job distribution. By the mid-1960s, nearly half of retail jobs and 50% of manufacturing jobs in major metropolitan areas had moved to the periphery. This spatial mismatch created a fundamentally new problem. Unlike whites who could choose housing based on workplace location or transportation access, blacks faced discriminatory housing practices that trapped them in areas increasingly disconnected from employment opportunities. In March 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan emerged another influential voice on ghetto issues with his controversial report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. Despite limited training in social sciences and minimal contact with black communities, Moynihan declared that family breakdown was the fundamental source of weakness in ghetto neighborhoods. He traced this to slavery's lingering effects, which had vitiated family life and hindered the emergence of strong father figures. Clark's Dark Ghetto, published in 1965, broke 20 years of silence in major social science books on the U.S. ghetto. Moving beyond his earlier psychological experiments with dolls, Clark confronted Northern de facto segregation, arguing it produced the same psychological damage as legally mandated Southern segregation. Drawing on his lifelong experiences in Harlem, Clark rejected cool, objective approaches, comparing himself to Holocaust scholars like Bettelheim and Frankel, who refused emotional detachment when studying concentration camps. Unlike Drake and Caton's earlier portrayal of semi-flourishing Bronzeville, Clark's ghetto showed no community spirit or upward mobility. Instead, it represented the institutionalization of powerlessness. Clark rejected Wirth's notion that ghettos were partly voluntary, arguing that when blacks preferred living apart, it reflected segregation's cruelest effect. Victims seeking respite from others' denigration ultimately internalized their inferiority. On February 28, 1978, relatively unknown University of Chicago sociologist William Julius Wilson published Poor Black's Future in the New York Times, summarizing his controversial book, The Declining Significance of Race. Wilson argued that economic transformation had made class increasingly more important than race in determining black life chances. In the new economy, educated blacks benefited from affirmative action and corporate opportunities, while those lacking education faced limited prospects, unemployment, and welfare dependency. Wilson's The Declining Significance of Race expanded on colleague Milton Gordon's concept of F-class, the intersection of ethnicity and social class, creating distinct social spaces. Beyond the simplistic race versus class debate it sparked, Wilson's book offered a sweeping historical analysis from the Civil War to the present. He argued that economic conflict between blacks and whites had shifted to socio-political spheres, with working-class whites no longer threatened by black labor, but competing politically over crime, schools, and housing. Wilson's claims provoked fierce opposition, particularly from Kenneth Clark, who emerged from retirement to publish No, No, Race, Not Class, Is Still at the Wheel in the New York Times. Clark insisted race remained the dominant factor in black life chances, arguing that middle-class blacks still faced tokenism in management positions and depended on white goodwill through special programs. By the late 1970s, black communities had transformed dramatically. Rather than the predicted continued ghettoization, large numbers of middle-class blacks were moving to mixed-race neighborhoods and suburbs, leaving behind increasingly isolated poor blacks. Meanwhile, cities like Washington, D.C., Detroit, and Atlanta developed substantial middle-class black communities. Following the Voting Rights Act, many cities elected their first black mayors and city councils, meaning ghetto authorities were now also black. What went largely unchallenged in Wilson's work was his use of the term underclass to describe poorly educated ghetto residents dependent on welfare or menial jobs. This concept, previously used by Gunnar Myrdal in Sweden, had gained currency through a recent Time magazine cover story depicting unreachable and antagonistic poor blacks. Wilson gave scientific authority to this label, describing the underclass in behavioral terms as disconnected from wider society's norms. Charles Murray, a Harvard-educated political scientist with a background in counterinsurgency work, emerged as a conservative voice on ghetto poverty. Murray argued that welfare programs had rationally incentivized ghetto residents to reject work. He claimed this was a community-wide response affecting entire generations, and speculated poor whites would behave similarly under the same conditions, though liberal policymakers held lower expectations for blacks. In 1987, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient William Julius Wilson published The Truly Disadvantaged, building on his earlier work by examining how racial and class demographics express themselves spatially. Wilson argued that ghetto joblessness stemmed primarily from economic factors and spatial mismatch between available jobs and worker skills. Unlike his earlier work, he no longer claimed blacks rejected low-wage work, instead advocating for universal economic programs that would disproportionately help blacks. Wilson introduced the Male Marriageable Pool Index to counter Murray's welfare dependency arguments, attributing family structure changes to male joblessness rather than welfare benefits. His concept of concentration effects explained how middle-class flight left poor blacks without social buffers, creating isolated ecological niches with severely restricted opportunities compared to poor whites who rarely lived in such concentrated poverty. Massey and Denton's American Apartheid, 1993, challenged Wilson by reasserting that racial segregation, not middle-class flight, was the ghetto's defining feature. They argued segregation resulted from ongoing racist forces, not just historical discrimination, and that welfare policies only harmed segregated communities by concentrating recipients in areas where dependency became normalized. By the time Wilson published his employer interviews, he'd shifted from arguing that employers required unfairly high education levels to accepting their hiring practices as reasonable. His theory in When Work Disappears presented a complex vicious cycle. Ghetto residents became ill-suited for available jobs due to social isolation, poor schools, and a culture of non-work. Black men, resentful of dehumanizing low-paid work, developed attitudes that reinforced employers' negative perceptions, especially during economic downturns. While previous approaches to addressing ghetto problems had proven discouraging, Jeffrey Canada emerged during the neoliberal moment with a compelling new vision. Unlike social scientists debating whether the ghetto was a problem of unemployment, welfare dependency, or racial segregation, Canada saw the ghetto as a self-contained entity that could be addressed directly through integrated services. Canada's outlook was shaped by his coming of age in the South Bronx during the civil rights era. Growing up in a violent neighborhood in the late 1950s, young Jeffrey learned the importance of self-defense and proving himself through fair ones, fistfights governed by unwritten rules. His memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, describes a childhood where status derived from fearlessness and being cold, concealing one's humanity while navigating a hierarchy that constantly shifted as one moved from elementary to junior high to high school. After earning degrees from Budin and Harvard, Canada worked at Boston's Robert White School for Emotionally Disturbed Boys, where he gained crucial insights about controlling violence. He discovered that a few program busters could undermine any environment if left unchecked, and that many intimidating boys only fought when adults were present to intervene. As director, he transformed the school culture by offering to take fighting boys to an unsupervised location. Given this choice, they invariably chose to return to class instead. While 1980 social scientists like Wilson focused primarily on improving job prospects for adults in the ghetto, Canada concentrated on helping children in violent neighborhoods. He joined the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem on the condition he could establish a martial arts school, having earned a black belt in Taekwondo. The Chang Mu Khan Taekwondo Club was born, though ironically, between Canada's departure for college in the early 1970s and his return to New York in the early 1980s, guns had largely replaced physical ability as the primary means of self-defense. Canada recognized that street norms had fundamentally changed. The natural checks and balances that once prevented minor conflicts from becoming deadly had disappeared with the proliferation of guns. Previously, youth faced deterrents like possibly losing a fight or retaliation from an opponent's friends. Now, armed teenagers felt invincible. They could scatter threatening groups with bullets. The only check on behavior became one's own death. Influenced by Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point theory, Canada realized his programs needed greater scale to transform Harlem. He concluded that children in his programs were still overwhelmed by negative social cues from those outside the program. If enough children participated, however, positive behaviors could spread like a virus. The idea of college attendance would seep into your pores. With backing from billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller, who was impressed by Canada's willingness to adopt corporate measuring standards, the Reedland Center expanded from a $6 million to a $58 million budget and became the Harlem Children's Zone, covering 24 blocks with comprehensive services from infancy through adolescence, including baby college for parents of infants. Despite creating integrated services, Canada struggled to influence children's regular school hours until Mayor Bloomberg appointed Joel Klein as school's chancellor. With the administration's support, Canada established Promise Academy Charter School in 2004, starting with kindergarten and sixth grade. Paul Tuff of the New York Times documented this experiment, witnessing the emotional lottery night when 359 students applied for admission. Canada promised parents, "If your child gets into our school, that child is going to succeed." However, reality proved harsh. Incoming sixth graders tested 2 to 3 years below grade level in math, and by year end, some students tested worse than before. When confronted with these disappointing results, Canada faced pressure from his wealthy board members, including billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller and Kenneth Langone, who suggested removing bad apples and adopting stricter behavioral models used by other successful charter schools. Despite his $400,000 salary and board pressure, Canada initially resisted approaches that stigmatized poor black students. His billionaire funders viewed students like stock picks, wanting to protect the Harlem Children's Zone brand by selecting only motivated children who could demonstrate success. With limited time to prove his vision, Canada became a tough executive, firing Principal Terry Gray, who doubted his College for All promise, hiring Glenn Pinder as replacement, and watching as the superintendent and a dozen teachers quit. When Canada faced devastated students and parents, he took full responsibility rather than blaming the children. This failure marked a shift in Canada's approach. He now focused on reaching children much earlier, aligning with Oscar Lewis's controversial 1960s view that intervention after age 6 or 7 comes too late. This contradicted William Julius Wilson's belief that opportunity structures, not cultural values, should be the focus. During his 2007-2008 presidential campaign, Barack Obama pledged to replicate the Harlem Children's Zone in 20 cities nationwide, promising federal funding for half the costs. "We can't afford not to," he insisted, comparing the $46 million annual cost to save a generation of children against the equivalent of 4 hours of Iraq war spending. However, the economic recession Obama inherited made it impossible to commit billions to such programs. Instead, in 2010, his administration launched a more modest Promise Neighborhoods initiative, awarding planning grants to 21 communities and later implementing grants of about $25 million to selected areas. The black ghetto has transformed from a place of semi-flourishing despite segregation to one with increased external control. In early ghettos, black men worked servile jobs but returned to communities with less police presence than today. Drake and Caton barely mentioned police in their studies. Since the 1960s, the war on drugs has dramatically increased policing and incarceration rates in black communities. Nearly 20% of black men in their 30s have served prison time, rising to 60% among high school dropouts. The black ghetto concept remains crucial for understanding poor black communities today. Its defining characteristics include restricted residential space based on race and wealth, a mechanism that perpetuates prejudice without harming the dominant population, a site of vicious cycles where spatial inequality becomes rationalized as inherent to black life, differences of kind rather than degree from other poor neighborhoods, creation and ongoing control by outside institutions, continuous oppression through exploitation by landlords and economic exclusion, complex internal social dynamics where residents distinguish themselves morally despite external prejudice, a population struggling for decency against great odds while many successfully escape, and, fundamentally, an intergenerational phenomenon that persists across time. Drake and Caton's deliberate use of ghetto in black metropolis highlighted that black concentration in Chicago's blighted areas wasn't natural, but resulted from white power restricting black mobility. Kenneth Clark, one of Murdahl's assistants, later argued in Dark Ghetto that these neighborhoods faced epidemic problems requiring more than civil rights boycotts or sit-ins to solve. Clark viewed ghettos as powerless colonies where blacks felt routinely demeaned, though he maintained Murdahl's belief in America's cognitive dissonance between ideals and violations. William Julius Wilson shifted the discourse in 1978, arguing class factors were overtaking race in determining black life chances. As the black middle class escaped ghettos, they left behind an isolated, destitute population. This created a new form of ghetto characterized by geographic, social, and economic isolation. Wilson proposed fighting for race-neutral policies benefiting all poor Americans rather than race-specific initiatives, drawing criticism from those who saw this as legitimizing America's retreat from racial justice. Despite scholarly attention and the war on poverty, America largely failed to address ghetto conditions. By the 1990s, when budget surpluses might have funded a second war on poverty, the nation instead pursued wars abroad. Meanwhile, young whites and honorary whites moved into former ghetto neighborhoods, investing in real estate while separating their children in private or charter schools. Jeffrey Canada's Harlem approach relied on billionaire philanthropy rather than systemic change, revealing how Americans compartmentalize moral dissonance, protecting their own family's welfare above all else, which remains the foundation of the forgotten ghetto. The concept of the ghetto has evolved dramatically over five centuries, from Venice's Jewish Quarter to Nazi concentration camps to America's segregated neighborhoods. Yet throughout these transformations, certain patterns persist. The creation of bounded spaces that simultaneously control and nurture, the tension between external restrictions and internal flourishing, and the way segregated spaces become both reflections and reinforcers of broader social attitudes. What makes the ghetto concept uniquely valuable is its ability to illuminate the relationship between space and power. Unlike terms like slum or poor neighborhood that describe physical conditions, ghetto captures how spatial arrangements express and reinforce social hierarchies. The ghetto is never merely a residential pattern, but always a manifestation of power relationships between dominant and subordinate groups. The scholars who developed our understanding of the ghetto, from Horace Caton and St. Clair Drake to Kenneth Clark and William Julius Wilson, often experience firsthand the tension between academic study and lived experience. Their work reminds us that the ghetto is not merely an academic concept, but a lived reality with profound consequences for those within its boundaries.
As American cities continue to transform through gentrification, mass incarceration, and economic restructuring, the ghetto concept remains essential for understanding how racial inequality persists despite formal legal equality. By recovering the rich intellectual history of the ghetto, we gain crucial insights into both historical patterns of segregation and contemporary challenges of achieving genuine integration and equality in American society.